The ACN podcast is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners and sponsors, including the Agile Alliance. As a nonprofit membership organization, the Agile Alliance is an excellent resource to help you along your Agile journey. To learn more about the Agile Alliance and our other sponsors, as well as how you can become a sponsor or supporter of our show, please visit acnpodcast.org for more information. And thank you for your support. Good morning, everyone. This is the Agile Coaching Network. My name's Ray Arell. As always, this is not intended to sell you anything. It's intended to give back to the community about the things that we've learned in doing Agile adoptions for about the last decade. I hate putting the decade on there because it makes me feel a little bit older. But, you know, having been seeing different iterations across large companies as well as, you know, small teams, we get a group of people here together every other week, and we're on a virtual park bench that spans across the globe, which is pretty darn cool. And our intent here is to share our wisdom, share the good stories, as well as the ones that didn't go so well, in order to benefit the rest of you. So to get going, looks like the first question up here is from Adam. Adam, do you want to go ahead and represent your question?
Sure. So this is more of a discussion topic than a question per se. I know that one of the main things that teams, especially Scrum teams, struggle with is handling interrupts coming from outside the team and they're disrupting their flow and breaking their sprints. And I wanted to share some approaches that we use in our teams, and would like to listen to what anyone else has to add to the discussion.
Great. Why don't you give us some of the ideas that you're using?
Okay. So a while back, we were using Kanban, and because the nature of our projects changed, we moved from a more from a maintenance standpoint to developing a completely new product. We wanted to use to get the benefits of Scrum to get our velocity up, but we were very aware that we would be interrupted probably regularly due to the fact that we still had to maintain the old product and because of the culture of the organization we worked at. So we wanted to build in some ways to mitigate or some speed bumps to these interrupts so that teams wouldn't be affected. Basically, our teams work in a less like structure. So we have three Scrum teams that do planning together. Then they run their sprints over 3 weeks and do their demo, do their retrospectives, and start over again. We knew that we to be able to handle interrupts, someone would have to pick up the pain of these, and we wanted to be fair, so we wanted to share the pain over time. So what we decided was that for each sprint, one of the teams would volunteer to be what we call the Joker or the wildcard team. And they would pick up these interrupts and try to handle them in the least disruptive manner possible. And I'll get a bit into that. So when a team decides to be the Joker team for the sprint, they plan their sprint accordingly and they pick up less work than they would do normally. And after the 8 or 9 sprints we've had so far, we've managed to approximate this effort caused by the interrupts fairly well. So this has been going pretty well. And I wanted to talk about maybe where the interrupts come from and how we handle them. But before that, anyone have anything to chime in with?
Well,
Adam.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Adam, it's Alan. Hi.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah. I've got a question. I love the sound of this Joker concept. Did you have any problem getting people to volunteer to be a Joker?
No. I think the teams, no one likes it, but the teams understand this. Plus, right. Since we do planning with paper, with the stories on paper cards, I actually have a Joker card from a card deck, and people just love taking that one. So,
oh, okay, That's a good way of making it more attractive. Thanks.
Well, one thing is that can help break up the mundane a little bit. So if you're always working on the same thing all the time, you know, having the kind of cool little side project sometimes is actually something that helps to kind of refresh you a bit, you know.
Yeah. So interrupts can come in. Oh, go ahead.
Hi, Adam. I think your approach here is pretty novel. I think what's kind of more the standard is typically one team gets the ticket that they continuously work on business as usual or support, whatever you call it, and that ends up becoming pretty demoralizing. I think it's good that you even have the opportunity with the three teams that they can take turns doing the support. I'm curious if you've thought about how you might handle this if you didn't have that, you know, that particular setup happening where you really do have three different teams that can handle the work.
If we just had one team, and I'm completely spitballing here, is we'd probably ask maybe a people to pair up to be the Joker pair for the given week, for example, so to shorten the period of time that they're on call, and pair up so they can have a more diverse skill set.
So you also use it as a learning opportunity as well, which is good.
Yes, and this has been actually very very useful because it does put people a bit on the spot where they have to at least do some initial triaging. Just an example from last week where our team maintains our own build infrastructure, and you know, as our main infrastructure specialist was getting on a plane for the U.S., everything crashed and burned. So, you know, the other people in his team who haven't been doing much with the infrastructure were had to start or doing some triaging and look at the stuff. And, you know, after a day of fighting, they've slowly become experts in maintaining the infrastructure as well. So, and, you know, they at least took the time to document what they found because this was new to them. So this actually worked out fairly well.
Well, that's really cool. You know, one of the things that most teams I don't think really give a lot of thought to is, you know, that it almost like they pretend like defects don't occur, that you know, that there isn't new work that might come in. And I think that the challenge always is that when people go off and establish these systems, they plan their capacity too high on just normal new features, and they end up scrapping half of that plan because of those interrupts that come in. So having a dedicated team in this particular regard is pretty good. But to your second question, which was how do other teams deal with interrupts and interrupt-based systems? Do other people have any ideas of other types of systems that they've used similar to the Joker card or something different?
Yeah, I've used, that's Jörg speaking, I've used something that would probably fit complementary because I spend a lot of time making sure my teams understood the priority that was allowed to be applied to interrupts. So maybe taking a bit the view of the embedded programmer who doesn't hate interrupts but needs to handle them, we really agreed on a very regular basis what are priorities that people will take, because for the overall success of the product, it's clear that anyway, they take precedence. Where can they take their own judgment? Do they think they can fit it into a corridor we established? Actually, sometimes even individually, on how much time we are willing to just prepare in advance, or whether they just simply say, no, we will not do it, find another way how to get that solved. And that gives a lot of autonomy and easy decision making. So that probably would fit pretty much to the concept. And I've got one question for Adam. Who came up with this? Did you do it or did the teams do it, the Joker concept?
We actually, we didn't set out to use Less or Scrum or something. When me and my manager realized that Kanban wasn't working for our team, we set out and wrote out a list of requirements we would have for a process that we thought would work well. We indicated where the knobs are, that the teams could tweak, and we presented this model to the team, and they bought it. The Joker wildcard team was our idea, but to be honest, me and my manager are probably the most agile experienced in the group, so we had the most thoughts on this. At the same time, we wanted to make sure that the teams are very clear on the fact that we don't like interrupts, and our philosophy is try to, if it's a longer interrupt, try to see if we can turn it into a backlog item instead of something that needs attention immediately, which isn't always possible, but. Sometimes it is, sometimes you have to deal with it right there and then.
Yeah, I think the one thing that really strikes me on, I think, both of the models that I've heard so far has been that there is it's the opt-in, it's the let's go ahead and self-organize around whatever this is. So even though that you came up with the methodology and introduced it to the team, it still wasn't like you said, well, somebody's got to go pull this card and all this other stuff. It's you actually put the ownership and the self-organization back on the team for them to be able to choose. And I think that makes it a really good system, because then people feel in control of their day a little bit better.
Yeah, and what I found is that the bigger the team, the less likely that someone will volunteer to do something, or maybe to rephrase it, the bigger problem you need for people to actually start addressing it. So when we had a team of 18 people working in Kanban, and you'd ask, who can help with this problem, then suddenly everyone was off doing their own thing. But now if we have a team of a Scrum team of about 6 people, and we say, red team, we need a volunteer, they'll choose someone during their stand-ups or quickly meet and organize around the problem.
Okay. Yeah, that's really good. I'm kind of curious, because of capacity issues, because one of the problems I had in one of my teams a long time ago was we had a tremendous amount of interrupts. And what we dug into and found out is not every one of those interrupts were a necessity. They were just the sales department, kind of going crazy of saying that my customer has this need and I need it now. And they would bring to bear any justification they can to go for an escalation if they needed to. And it just got out of control. Do you have that problem within the system?
So what we do is we track, if we get an interrupt that takes more than a few hours to solve, then that gets added as a story in the sprint and gets marked that it came in as a wild card mm-hmm. into the sprint. So at the end of the sprint, we have some metrics on how much of this came in. Plus, a developer can start working on a Joker task if that comes through his side channels, but because he puts it into the Jira we use, me and my manager both know that there's a new wildcard, and we can quickly go over and say, nope, this isn't important. Stop. We'll handle it. We'll block the stakeholder or something. Or no, good decision. And if the developer doesn't know, isn't sure which option is better, then he can always come and ask, do you think this is an interrupt, or is this something that will wait until our next sprint?
Okay.
So we have ways to limit this, and we're fairly strong on stopping these interrupts unless we do understand the business case for them.
Yeah, one of the methods that we employed to handle this was we created sort of coupons, and those coupons were associated with how many times one of our stakeholders could get a fast pass through the line of our development team. So we did it because we wanted to put the control of the decision back to the stakeholder. They give them 3 coupons per quarter. And if they wanted to go use one of those coupons to go through the fast pass, they could, but you only get 3. So that actually helped to really curtail, because the individuals that were involved would say, do I really want to spend it on this one, or do I want to wait for something that's really a high priority? And that worked really well for us.
That's good if you can
map your... Ray, did your stakeholders do trading of the coupons?
Yeah,
like, I don't need it, so...
You know, they did do that, and I didn't really care because from a capacity perspective, we knew that we would handle, I think it was like 20 of these that were sitting out there, coupons that are available per quarter. So we were able to plan for a team to be able to be available to be that sort of, you know, A team that could go off and do that relatively quickly. And literally, we didn't skip any of the processes. We just optimized it so that if it was around one task or one particular feature change or one particular defect fix, we weren't skipping any of the steps, but we just did it in a way that we can really optimize the flow for that to get it fast.
So one thing that happened to me this week with interrupts is how pushing back can often get a better result from your stakeholders. We had a team that's downstream from us using our product, and they ran into some issues with testing and asked for help. I said, well, not this week or next. And they came back, well, we started debugging. If you can just send us the source code for the test you use, that will help us, you know, root cause these problems. And I'm like, we can do that. So often, a little pushback often reveals a lot of information, I believe. So that's also useful.
Oh, I agree. How about other ways that people handle interrupts like this?
So I've had many teams who were, you know, in the position that not only did they do enhancements, they were always doing production support. And the challenge there was trying to figure out how do you get any of the enhancements done if you're constantly being pulled away to do some sort of production support. And the way I worked with several teams and had some good success with this was to actually create a quote-unquote story, not a real story, but it was oftentimes just called it unplanned work. And the agreement with the team was that every time they had to do some amount of unplanned work, mm-hmm. didn't matter what it was, we don't score it. We did record hours just so we could understand at the end of the sprint how much of an interrupt it had caused. But the teams would track their tasks under that story and whatever tool we were using and track the hours. And the good thing about that is that almost without exception, for every team I've done this with, we found most organizations have a pattern and a level of interruption.
Right.
And oftentimes that pattern, it may have peaks and valleys, right? For example, if you work in the healthcare industry, this time of year, there's a particular kind of reporting that goes on that causes a spike in many healthcare companies. So what that allowed us to do then was to be a little smarter when we were doing planning.
Right.
And so allow for more some sprints versus others. And then simply by doing the quick thing of tracking it, we were able to report back to the customer, and here's how we spent our time, right?
Right.
So then it put them in a position to then say, if you get calls like that anymore, that call can go to the help desk, don't deal with it, or, you know, some particular problems would start to evolve a pattern, and instead they get more proactive and say, well, maybe we need to adapt this feature or something. But it turned out being quite useful for them.
Well, I think being able to stare at that data, and then I think it sounds like both of the processes that I've heard, and we even did that with ours as well, is we made sure that in our retrospective process that we were really looking at, one, understanding that as we were going into planning that, you know, hey, 30% of this time is not available to us. It's going to be available for these interrupts that are going on there. And that made it, I think, a lot smoother from a flow perspective, because it was, you know, we knew it was going to come. And if we didn't spend it, then we just picked up another feature and brought it in. So all good processes. So do we want to stay on this story? Does anyone else have anything to share in this space, or do we want to move on to the next?
I have one or two more things that might come in handy.
Sure.
One is less of a process thing, but, you know, having a wiki with a FAQ and maybe some tools you use available to your downstream users can resolve a lot of issues by saying, go to this wiki and just read up on it. So that's also been a big time saver for us. You know, how do I do this? Here's the link.
Sure.
The other thing, it might be, you know, it might be the final solution, but you might consider this. I was listening to a talk a while back at a conference, and the presenter said that her team was spending one 2-week sprint a year on maintaining their project, each of their projects that was in maintenance, and they did a portfolio review, and they had 26 projects. Mm. And that's when they realized that that's why they're not developing anything new. So they just went ahead and, you know, end-of-lifed some projects, sold off others, and so on. And maybe, you know, if you're getting a lot of interrupts for some of your projects, maybe it's time to end-of-life them, because it's just not worth maintaining.
Well, it's healthy to do that every once in a while, especially if you have long product cycles. I was in a set of products that had a 7-year lifespan to them. And I know that when we put out the call to say last features for this, and if you were going to bring in the last feature, you needed to also bring the customer with you to represent it. We saw that there was very few people coming in to asking for something. It was just maybe our field application engineer who found some pet peeve in there, but the customer never saw it. They never, you know, basically experienced it. So we were sort of fixing things for ourselves, which is okay, but, you know, we've got other things we also have to do as well. Those are really good points. So I'm going to go ahead and grab, and Adam, I know you have the next question up here, but you're in a tie with another person. So I'm going to go pick another question here. And if this is your question, go ahead. and if this is your question, you can come and let me know what your kind of a deeper understanding of the problem here. And it's, I've been doing a lot of training lately, poised question is, why use story points? And how do they benefit us beyond hours estimates? Whoever had that question, if you want to give us a little bit more on that. So if not, let's go ahead and talk about user stories and versus, you know, what we do from an hours benefits perspective. Does anyone want to start?
Okay, let me start. And one thing I've seen often is that story points are just seen by people who are inexperienced as an other unit of ours. They already think in effort. And one thing you need to make sure is that what you estimate there is not how long does it take for me to get this done, but include risk, include uncertainty, to really make sure you get to a flow and an estimation of what you can do. And that's the intention. And often you get people to recognize this when you tell them this is still just a clutch, and at one point you even can work there by just having the amount of stories in the sprint. So consider that it's just more or less helping you to understand what you're doing here. And as with planning, is getting to the right amount of story points is often a very educating process for new things, using poker planning or what have you, to get an understanding of what am I missing when I'm looking at the explanation from the product owner, and what is the guy missing who is just ordering the straightforward good case.
Right.
And all of this makes it extremely helpful.
Yeah, and to expand on that, I think what sometimes is missed is exactly what you said about what is the process that we use to eventually get to ours? And story points is a way of being able to do relative sizing versus other tasks that we've done before, but also comprehend things that unfortunately most developers are not really good at, which is how do I break this down in a way that has some representation of that complexity and risk that might be in this. And that's the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns that might exist in a task or a story or something that we're doing. And it's really about the exercise of vetting that out. And if you just gave a simple hour estimate, it doesn't really give a good understanding of whether or not you were following something to break that down with. And story points kind of gives that. It gives you another method or approach to it. How about others?
In my experience, this is Alan. In my experience, one of the reasons people get stuck with points and they keep reverting back to hours or days is because when they do those estimates in hours or days, whether they're agile, waterfall or whatever, they're not actually incorporating the complexity and risk. They're just thinking, yeah, that'll take me 8 hours. So story points, as Jörg says, is, you know, they're not considering the effort, but considering just the, you know, the complexity. So we're saying, don't include the risk. Don't include the hours that it would take you. Just think relative size. And I think teams over, you know, several decades have been really bad at this. And we say, right, use story points because it's easier. And they go, no, it isn't. It's just confusing. And I think it's because they're not actually doing the estimation in hours and days right in the first place. And what we're saying is estimating in hours and days is really hard. So use story points and sequence your stories, put them in order. Is this one bigger than that one? Is this one smaller than this one? And there you've got your story points. I think that's typically why teams have so much difficulty. It's because they're not typically good at estimating in the first place.
Absolutely.
Well, that's my experience.
I think that's one thing I just want to highlight again, because I actually nearly missed it, but Ray and Alan, you said it. It's the relative estimation that makes the big, big difference. Compare it to something where everybody agrees what it is. And that's actually pretty hard. First of all, the agreeing and then the comparison. But that's more important than everything else, because it brings the team together on understanding what they want to do or what they need to achieve.
Right. And foundationally, if you look at the differences between I give you an hours estimate or we're going to have a discussion about how many hours it's going to take with the group mind versus the individual mind, or, you know, same thing with the story points. We're going to have a group discussion where, and I've seen this many a times when, you know, a developer says, well, it's going to take me about a day. And then you go over and the tester in the room says, no, this is not going to take us a day. This is going to take us a week because, yeah, that's one line of code change, but the regression on this thing is incredibly huge because of all of the different configurations that need to be tested. And I think that one of the things when people give you that pushback on, hey, my hours versus team hours or team capacity and other things, I think that this just opens that door to have that discussion with the group of, yeah, I think it's bigger than this, or I think it's smaller than this. And that's a healthy discussion to have in a team. Now, the question of hours as well, and, you know, and I've hit this a lot of times with teams, and I'll see them do story points and hours. Do you think that's a good practice? Does anyone think that's
it's kind of a wasteful practice. I always think, If a team is, you know, brand new to Agile or Scrum, or they're really struggling with delivering on their commitments, then they absolutely need to break down those stories into tasks and estimate those tasks in hours. Then that will give them, you know, a much better feeling of whether they estimated this 3-point story correctly. Because when they look at the tasks, they go, whoa, that's more like an 8 or a 13 or something like that. So that's one thing I would say. What else? Anybody else?
I never understood how you could put hours to tasks, especially software development tasks. Because if a task takes 3 hours, does that mean I sit down at 8 and I'm done at 11? Or does that mean I'm going to pound the keyboard for 3 hours? Or does that mean I'll make a code change and then compile for 2 hours? I don't think those things have any bearing on reality. And
let me give you an example of a team that really demanded to do the hours for the tasks, I would say for years. They actually did the estimation for the stories and story points, and they didn't do that badly in terms of relative estimation and stuff, but they always, for every spin, they wanted to have their tasks in hours. And for them, it was really, how much work do I need to put into this? And not a prediction of when am I done. So 3 tasks of two stories are not necessarily done in a day, but one person spends 6 hours over the sprint on this, roughly. That was always the approach. What they did as the main benefit, and that one was they did a sanity check. We think we should be able to doing that many story points in the sprint, but let's sum up the tasks as early as possible and see if you're running a risk. And especially in the early phase, they found a lot of risks and did a lot of corrections much earlier than they would have done if they hadn't done this so thoroughly.
Yeah, but there's a...
Yeah, I think... Sorry, Ray. No. I was going to say, I think if a team is delivering on their commitments, i.e., their estimation in story points is pretty good, then estimating tasks in hours is actually a waste of time. I always think it's useful for them to do that if they're not able to meet their commitments. So in other words, their sizing in story points is not sufficient, or they've been having too many interrupts, etc. So if a team have been together for a while and they're getting good at this thing, then that's one of the things. Estimating in hours is something that I would recommend them dropping.
Yeah, they actually demanded as a kind of insurance. They still wanted to do it. I actually agree with your view, but from the team that came back, we still want to do it to be sure we're doing the stuff.
Yeah, but
well,
one thing.
I guess it's a comfort blanket.
But one thing to be careful.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I'm just saying one thing to be careful with is, and this is something that I had a science teacher tell me one time in chemistry, and that was he used to pound it in our head saying sig figs, significant figures, and that don't go measure something down to a micrometer or down to the 10th decimal place when you don't have enough data to do that. And I think one of the strugglings that most teams have is when you have that, you have high degrees of precision when you know what line of code to go change, but you have really no aspect of, you know, just other than a relative guess that I think it's going to hopefully take me less than 8 hours to do this so that I can fit the deadline. And do I know what's going to take me 8 hours? Heck, I haven't even opened up the patient yet to understand what's there. And I see some teams fall into the hours trap where they go, it's 8 hours, it's 20 hours, it's, you know, it's going to take me, 1,000 hours. And when they get up to those big numbers, I think that's when you just got to call BS. You know, it's like, you don't know, you know. And so is it better to continue the game of anything that's, you know, outside of a 2 hour block of time? Do you really want to continue to just add more hours to it just to give a guesstimate? I don't know. I don't know what others feel about that.
So Ray, the whole thing here is hinged on two factors. One would be you have a reasonably unbiased estimation process where you're as likely or nearly as likely to be over as under. And then the law of large numbers comes to your aid and says that on average, you're going to come out all right. You're going to be fat on some stories and thin on others, but at the end of the sprint, you'll be close.
Right.
But the other thing that's interesting in this discussion, as Alan said, you know, people are using story points to size stories. And because of a bunch of work I've been doing on complexity lately, that rang a bell, because in Melanie Mitchell's wonderful book on complexity, she defines complexity in a variety of ways. One of them is size. But who's to say that a team's estimate of story points based on the size of the story is also properly encountering the various forms of complexity that might be beneath that? Information complexity, if I've got to make a database of 20 tables, that's a size estimate. There's 20 tables, but the complexity of that database could be enormous, or it could be a really simple flat file.
Sure.
So I think it, as long as a team has a reasonably unbiased estimate, and as long as the team is incorporating various ideas around complexity and not just some basic superficial idea of size to their stories, they're probably going to come out okay.
So what you're saying is we're worrying about it too much?
Well, no. One of the things to take away here because of what Alan triggered is, aha, if we talk to teams about estimating story size, we should at least seed them with the idea that the number of lines of code is only one measure of size. The number of hours is an approximation of some of these other effort things. But you've got to look at other things like the novelty of the situation or the complexity in terms of algorithms and information content. It's not just, is it a 20 table database?
Right.
So what kind of database is it? So if we can make that a more common practice in story points and estimation, then I think the process is really going to start to focus in on the right stuff.
I don't disagree with you. Just to share a story, I saw probably the best story point planning session that I've ever seen. It was at Menlo Innovation, and the way that they did it was they took a sheet of paper, and that sheet of paper, you know, 8.5 by 11, or maybe a big, you know, A3 type of size paper, and they wrote each of the stories per a visual aid of a card of a particular size, meaning if it was a really large story, it was a large piece of paper that still could fit in within that sheet of paper that they were going to put it on. And so what they ended up having was, you know, different sizes size papers for a different size story. And what they would do is that they would put it on that, you know, what they called the sprint paper, and they could only put as number of those post-its that could fit. And that means that, you know, you can have two large pieces of stories on there, or you can only have, or you can have 16 of the smaller ones, and so on and so forth. And I think it gave a really good, that kind of missing component to that most people can't comprehend when they're thinking of story points, is we're trying to see what fits in the sprint. That's the intended goal of, we want to reach 100% done at the end of the sprint, and are we filling up our dance card correctly? And I think that having visual aids like that really helps. Any other ideas on this, or do we want to move on to another topic?
So just a quick add, because there cannot be a topic where I don't chime in. in my teams, we play fairly loose with the story points. We don't do any formal estimations and so on. Teams use it as a language to communicate with each other. But an interesting thing happens during the sprint, because we do allow teams to change the story point estimates and stories as they work on them. And it provides a nice flagging mechanism. If suddenly something shoots up, it can mean one of two things. One is, whoa, we completely did not understand this task, and we actually had one task that shut up from 8 to 24 story points, I think, which triggered some decomposition in flight. The other main reason for this we notice is that the definition of done was written poorly or misunderstood by the developer that started working on the story. And they thought they were supposed to do something much more complicated. So that gives us a quick, a quick warning that something was misunderstood at some point. So we found that very useful.
Very good. Any other last thoughts on this topic? Okay. Next question. We're struggling to decompose stories into vertical slices, I guess is what the question is. We got an understanding that understanding of the need to keep them short, but we keep slicing them horizontally. Adam, do you want to expand on that?
I believe it was fairly self-explanatory. Our teams keep thinking, I'll do this layer of the API, then this layer, and so trying to get one through line across the whole feature, and then try build up on that.
Mm-hmm.
I've not pushed too hard against that for two reasons. One is that I know my team is delivering well, and I don't want to disrupt them too much. And two, I don't have a good way to sell them on this.
Okay. So I always found that the, you know, vertical versus horizontal slicing depends on the makeup of my team, meaning can I outfit my crew with the necessary talent to take it across as a vertical slice? And most of the time we suffer from you know, I think it's Conway's law that says that, you know, I'm going to have a team worth of middleware team and a team of, you know, BIOS and a team of others. And it's sometimes hard to construct a team that can work across all of the slice of the architecture. The second problem is just the architecture itself. And that is that, was it well engineered that it could work in that manner? Could you actually take a vertical slice and create it? I think that in older architectures, especially ones that are kind of glued to hardware very tightly, that's a little bit difficult to do. But in sort of the newer architectures that we go off and create with, you know, design patterns that cause, you know, either, you know, micro blocks and other things that could be put together easier, I think those ones become easier to do a vertical slice. How about others? Any experience in this? Oh, that's a long quiet thing there. You know, just one other add to it. I think that when you look at slicing itself, the question gets back to the same thing as story points. What are we trying to vet out by doing it in that manner? And so I find that story mapping, you know, that process that's, I think it was either David Hussman or version one had came up with, I'm not sure exactly who the author was, but go look at David Hussman's work on it, because he actually at least breaks down the structure of stories in order for them to actually work in that manner. You know, what's the basic path, the happy path, where are the, you know, the different vertical and horizontal layouts that you can do while doing that exercise. I would probably recommend that if you introduce it to the team, you could say, hey, why don't we try it and see if it actually gains some benefit. And if it doesn't benefit, just back it off and don't do it anymore. Is probably the best bet on that.
Can you spell that for me and our listeners?
Oh, spell what part? The
Hussman?
Hussman? I'll put it in the chat line.
Okay, great.
So let's go ahead and roll on. We've got time probably for another question here. Let's see. It's interesting. We got voted up one that I put in, and it's something that we were talking about, Jorgen and I, before everyone else joined, and that was, when can you call yourself agile? Because, you know, there's some teams out there today that says, hey, we're agile, or we're not agile, or we're almost agile, and it seems to be an inconsistent bar. What do people think? When can you call yourself that?
I think you can call yourself agile whenever you want, because there's no real trademark and anything else banning you from it. And so it depends a lot on the purpose and the message you're selling, why you're using that. But I think, and we've been on the mindset topic a lot, if you aim to achieve customer satisfaction, learning, flow, all those things, then the time starts when you can call yourself agile. And probably that's as well the point in time when it doesn't really matter anymore, that you have that badge so proudly showing. But when you can start telling real success stories why this is helping you, and you can start sharing best practices.
So when you're saying when you reached a level of experience that, you know, you're recognized by your peers, or is something that you say, well, I've got something to add to the story here?
Yeah, that's as soon as you can tell a story that says, I did this following this reasons, and that's my success, so why don't you try it? Then this label agile goes to the background, because you can really map it to something solid and tangible. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a difference. A lot of times, agile is a way to sell a change to management that doesn't want to change these days. And for that purpose, you can use a lot of interpretations when you call yourself agile.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of teams and organizations call themselves agile when they are so clearly not. And I think it, like a lot of things, I think it all comes back to the agile principles. And if you look at the principles, there's a fair few stakeholders in there. There's the customer, you know, are they receiving valuable product regularly? Ask them, You know, there's many ways you can survey the customer, either at the end of a sprint, the end of a release, whatever. Then there's the quality and maintainability of the software. Is your software, you know, maintained by a third party? Ask them if you're developing quality, maintainable software, etc. And you know, not the least of which of those stakeholders is the team. You know, are they finding that working in this inverted commas agile team is more fun, less stressful, generally happier? Then you can probably call yourself agile if you tick all those boxes. But I think it all comes down to those agile principles. But there's no one person, I think, that can tick all those boxes. It has to be the multiple stakeholders feeding into that.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think it's really, the declaration is we're striving to be a more agile team is probably a better response. I think that if you meet agile teams that have been doing it very well for, you know, 5 years, and you ask them the question, how are you agile yet? And they'll tell you, you know, we're on the journey, you know, we're still working on it. We're continuously learning, continuously refining, continuously. So you could, in fact, declare them agile, but they've chosen that as a more of a, this is the way we want to work. And no, we're not perfect all the time. And I think that's a better response when people come across that way.
I would say that if you go to a team and ask them, what's the last thing you changed to improve the way you work? If they can answer and answer with enthusiasm, they're probably agile or you know, on the agile journey. If they can't remember, I think that's a very strong sign that they're not being agile in any
right
manner. It's for me, the core of agile is continuously improving yourself, and if you keep doing that, you'll get wherever you want to be.
Yeah, and I think back to Alan's point, you know, it all comes back down to the values. You know, are those values something that we can observe and see within the teams, regardless of the methods that we're using? And if those values are there and present, and I think, yeah, it's fair game to call yourself an agile team and going on that journey. So I'm going to do something interesting. I'm going to go squeeze at the bottom of the list, just because sometimes those get, you know, down there too long. This one is, could you share some examples of how Agile can be integrated into other functions, such as HR? Has implementations been done successfully outside of IT? Anyone want to jump on that one?
Well, HR is easy. They have their own Agile manifesto, right?
I've seen that. Do you want to describe it to people?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Off the top of my head.
Well, yeah, there has been a trend, because I met somebody, I think about 3 years ago at the main Agile conference here in the U.S., and they declared themselves an Agile HR person. And it was interesting to sit down and have a conversation with her about what did that mean. And it was sort of the kind of framing it in the scope of we're in service of the development team. We need, if they're working iteratively, we should be working iteratively. And they did have a rift of the manifesto that was towards their job function. And of course, they're not delivering code. They should be helping to develop and deliver, you know, great talent, you know, to the organizations, depending on what organization you're in. So,
then,
go ahead.
The same things apply, right? Do you bring value to all your stakeholders? Do you continuously improve as a team? Are you happy with your work, and is everyone around you happy? Then, you know, this you're cultivating agile.
Right. And
hey, could I ask a question?
Sure.
My name's Jeff. I asked the question. I just wanted to, I work for a large aerospace company, and a lot of what we do in HR is processes. And so I've been trying to reconcile the HR manifesto and the principles of Agile, which are heavy against like processes and things like that. And so HR being so heavily focused on the processes, mm-hmm. I guess, is there a way that you can implement Agile as you're trying to do processes? That's one of the toughest,
okay.
You know,
Yeah, and I can give you some.
And I know I sound like a very novice person because I am. So I really want to make sure, I really want to implement Agile, but I want to understand it fully before I go about trying to, you know, break things. So.
Sure. I mean, at the foundational level, as we've talked on this call before, if you look at the manifesto and look at, you know, things like, you know, high communication between team members, that we're constantly looking at if something changes, we're open to that change and so on and so forth. So you've got the values component. And I always recommend teams that are outside of, quote, the IT circle that it was originally invented in to take the manifesto and rewrite it yourself. You know, even though there's that other one that's been written for HR, with your team, write it down. What does individual interactions mean to us? And sort of put it in a plain language of how you would observe it. You know, this is it happening, and this is it not happening. What would be, you know, the way that you could say that, you know, we've crossed the line and went over the barrier there. So that's the sort of the first exercise that you should kind of do as a team. Beyond that, all even software teams and others have governance that needs to be established. And I know governance sometimes sounds like a dirty word, but, you know, we can use the word policy or policies. And those policies are something that, you know, we don't want them to be, you know, too rigid, but sometimes there's laws and other things that we have to abide by, and they're non-negotiables within that. But on the stuff that has much more flexible boundaries to them, you know, it's the question of, you know, what iterations are we going to do to revisit our work on this type of project? So as you look at your delivery processes for, say, we have the annual process of doing reviews with employees or quarterly reviews or whatever those are. What would be my iterative process to do that so that it would, you know, fit better with the teams that we're supporting? And really measure that customer value quotient a lot tighter to understand where are we delivering value and where we're not delivering value, and how do we address those, and then work in an iterative fashion. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Yeah. Thank you very much for answering that question.
No problem. I think the main thing is you need to frame it in your power words, because, you know, in any transformation, I think the biggest thing that we struggle with is this is how we used to do things. You know, we would deliver on annual cadence on these things, or we'd deliver, you know, very long cycles on this, or even just how we answer employee questions about, you know, my health benefits. You know, what would be the, how would I make that an iterative process and something that we would be continuously improving, so that when you polled your customers, your employees, they would say, man, I get right through and I never ever get stuck in a queue for very long. How about others? Go ahead.
Yeah, to share another practice, one that I like at our office, is that HR organizes something like these park benches, like the one we're participating in now, for people managers, so they can ask questions of HR, but also share some experiences they have with managing people, and maybe resolve in conjunction with HR some issues that might seem to be legal issues, but maybe there is a way to, you know, be compliant and at the same time solve the problem. So I think that's a good example of collaboration and bringing people together to solve problems together.
Yeah, those, and, you know, those
otherwise they could just send out PowerPoint slides and say, this is what you need to do.
That is disastrous when that happens. Having been a people manager for a number of decades, I can tell you that the biggest issue always comes to, how do I interpret this new rule? And so those types of forums that says, you know, I can ask those questions directly of an HR person is absolutely a big benefit to me. Okay, we are at the top of the hour. As always, this podcast goes up onto iTunes and SoundCloud and Google Play, and I think those are the only three places they really go sit on. But you're also welcome to, you know, share them with your friends and let them know that, you know, there's some good value in listening to the podcast. This is our 12th episode, and I really enjoy the time that we spend on a biweekly basis here. And I hope you guys go off and have a great couple of weeks.